This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Quote, easy answer is to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's not the best answer.
It is not. Throwing babies is never the answer.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, No April's Fool, Kathleen Porter McGee.
Nice.
All right. Hey, did you enjoy this year's April Fool's Day Gladfly?
I did. And as I think I mentioned to you, I think this was the 10th anniversary Gladfly edition.
Yeah, it makes me feel old.
I know.
And let me tell you, folks, if you haven't read it, you got to go to our website, check it out, what came out on April 1st, our spoof version of the April of the Education Gadfly. And we need you to read it only because, you know, we have spent something like 1,000 man hours on this over the last, 2 months?
More than 2 months. I think the planning for next year has already begun.
I know. We start early. This is the most important thing we do all year.
Apparently.
It is, it's hard being funny, right?
Yes.
And then, you know, you also got to pick out, you know, who you want to make fun of, you know, what things are worth spoofing. And of course, the funniest things don't actually happen until about 2 weeks before the event. But we did have a lot of fun with it. Hope you did too. There's a fun video up there. You'll see the spoof podcast where we supposedly, Rick and I, were going to be talking about wheelchair basketball, transgendered bathrooms,
nice.
And how fat Karen Lewis is.
Oh.
And Amber was going to quit in disgust. And I hope people clicked on that because they probably thought, huh, this sounds like it could be real. This doesn't sound so far off the mark. This could actually have happened. Okay, enough with that. We're on to real education news and views this week. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Pamela, get us started.
In his latest Times column, Thomas Friedman argues that schools ought to be promoting motivation and creativity over basic knowledge. Does he have a point?
No. He does not have a point. This is an age-old argument that what you know isn't as important as what you can do with knowledge. And now that we all walk around with iPhones and iPads and can get information at the click of a button, it doesn't matter what you learn in school. And it's so wrong. In fact, I think it gets wronger, if that's even a word, the further along we get. Now, in the 21st century, I mean, first of all, anything you can get from Wikipedia does not make you an expert. So the ease of information is really basic information. And second of all, I think the only way to differentiate yourself in this day and age when information is so easy to get is through depth of expertise and depth of content knowledge, not by Googling things.
Well, that's right. And that the way, look, he's quoting Tony Wagner, whose recent book is on innovation. I interviewed Tony Wagner for the Education Next Book Club podcast. People might check that out. And I pushed him on this. And there's a review in EdNext of the book as well. And Mark Bauerlein pushes him on this. And part of it is saying, hey, what Tony Wagner did was found a handful of amazing young people, kind of people who are designing the iPhone, other kinds, and, you know, have done great things already in their young lives, and say, okay, well, what worked for you? What kind of education did you get? And lo and behold, a lot of them went to more progressive schools or had parents who let them play in the woods all day, you know, who had kind of Waldorf-y kinds of experiences as kids. And so Tony Wagner says, this is what we need for everybody. But as Mark Bauerlein points out, you know, picking out these few examples, the Steve Jobs of the world, let's say, and designing an education system around them is nuts because by their very nature, they are exceptional kids, exceptional people. And it doesn't tell us, okay, how do we educate 50 million kids to be prepared for the broad challenges that they're going to face?
Well, and even more simply, those kids also probably know a lot.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of these progressive schools actually teach a lot of content. They do it in a non-traditional way, and we can have that pedagogical conversation, but they are still teaching stuff. They are still teaching content.
Yeah.
So we can talk about teaching it differently, but kids still need to learn things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they can learn things. Look, I'm a big believer. I mean, E.D. Hirsch has argued this for a long time, and I'm coming to see it, that especially in the early elementary grades is such a great time to do more knowledge. And this is exactly when most schools are teaching crap when it comes to social studies and science. The conversation I had with Nico, 5 years old, this morning. James Monroe is really one of my favorite presidents. Right?
Nice.
I mean, crazy. My wife was like, what is freaky? What is going on? Now, maybe that's over the top, but he's got this tape we listened to about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and James Monroe was a guy that was sent by Thomas Jefferson to negotiate with Napoleon for the... My little five-year-old knows all this stuff, and he's curious about it, and he's interested. He's interested, right? Anyway, we should be building this knowledge. And then as the kids get older, it's more appropriate to do the more applied stuff. But it's got to be on a base of knowledge.
Well, the other thing, too, I think that Friedman's point was that what we need to teach is innovation. As if innovation were anything different than making connections that people haven't made before. So you have the knowledge and you see interesting connections in different places and how things work together. And you see that differently. That's where innovation comes from. It doesn't come from Wikipedia level knowledge.
Well said. Topic number two.
Early results from states that have recently overhauled their teacher evaluation systems show little change. Nearly all teachers are still passing. Is this cause for concern?
Well, not just passing, getting some of the highest ratings, right? Mm-hmm. And extremely few teachers are actually being identified as needing to get the boot or whatever their term might be in their state, which is never that clear, by the way. Like, I wish they have ratings. Like, this teacher sucks, right?
Maybe not that one exactly.
Maybe not.
But
all right, fine. I mean, so Kathleen, we've both been very skeptical of these teacher evaluation reforms, but are you surprised that it's coming out like this?
I'm not that surprised. I mean, I don't know. From what I've seen of the teacher evaluation reforms, it's not like they are so dramatically different. They still do include multiple measures. They're still very driven by observations and principal feedback. And by the way, I don't disagree with that, but I wouldn't expect a dramatically different result. Just because now there are a number of states that are including some test score data.
Yeah. I mean, look, no, it is hard. It is against human nature, I think, to get managers to give tough reviews to their employees, mm-hmm. right? Now, if you're in a field where there's a lot of accountability or competition and incentives for managers to make those tough calls, mm-hmm. like they'll get promoted if they're willing to fire bad people, or, you know, they'll get more money if they do so, or that, you know, whatever that might mm-hmm. be, you see it happening. But in education, we still have a situation where, for the most part, it is hard to tie consequences to these evaluations. Mm-hmm. So if you're a principal, you gain nothing by telling your teachers that they suck,
right?
Because you can't get rid of them anyway. You know, or even if you can, this is the cage busting leadership issue that Rick would bring up, is that there's a culture against it, against doing it, the culture of being nice. Look, when I was in the federal government, we had a big push to try to get more serious about evaluations, and a lot of us political appointees were on board. Okay, we're going to walk the walk here. And guess what happened? We did, and we got sued on various grounds. Oh, wow. Now, most of those court cases didn't go anywhere, but the point was, people have been around a long time knew, look, over, like, this is what's going to happen. There's going to be lawsuits. There's going to be racial discrimination suits. There's going to be all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, it's just going to suck up a lot of time, and nobody's actually going to lose their jobs because of it. So why bother?
Well,
and I think that's still at the heart of this is that, you know, why bother differentiating between teachers if it doesn't actually matter, and all it's going to do is create ill will towards you?
Well, and the other thing is, too, I mean, are we trying to change instruction through evaluation, but not expecting any more of our leaders in terms of setting a really clear instructional vision or setting right. a real, yeah, I mean, just, right. like, we're not
they don't
saying,
know what it looks like.
Yeah,
cases,
exactly.
Right?
They don't have a picture of excellence. And yeah. then we're saying you don't live up to it. It doesn't right. exist. There is right. no picture, but you don't live up to some.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I think it's problematic.
Principals go in and say, yeah, it looks pretty good to me.
Right.
It was better than what I did when I was a teacher.
Right.
All right. Topic number three.
Atlanta's ex-schools chief and three dozen others have been indicted in a test scandal. Is it time to admit the accountability movement has gone too far?
I struggle with this question a lot. So I think it's clear that we have a problem that we have to address. It's interesting. One of the things that I struggle with about the accountability movement is not that test-based accountability per se is problematic, but it's that we've only gotten it half right. I mean, at Fordham, we've always said it's the intersection of that kind of accountability and parental choice. And absent parents putting some external pressure on the school in terms of what they want for their kids, I think that we're seeing some of these distortions, and we're seeing some of the kind of myopic focus on
that's interesting. So in other words, you assume that parents don't want schools obsessed with nothing but tests.
Right.
So in places where parents have real power, like, say, affluent suburbs, mm-hmm. the schools are more balanced in their
right.
approach, right? Versus, say, in an urban education, in many cases, where the parents, for a variety of reasons, may not be as plugged in or powerful, the schools become testing factories.
Right.
Or cheat.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And also the tests, we haven't put enough pressure to make the tests worth giving, worth administering, or right. worth using. So we have a test problem. I think we have an accountability problem in the sense that the people who care the most about those kids, the parents, are not involved in the decision making. And I think that's a challenge. So I do think that we need to look at it, but I think we need to look at it differently than a lot of people are thinking.
Yeah, I talked to Motoko Rich at the New York Times about this week, and this was the same conversation. And it's basically to say, look, first of all, you want to have better tests. Common Core, we hope, is going to lead to that. You got to invest in test security. I mean, we just have to say, look, there are stakes attached. Some people are going to cheat. So mm-hmm. we need to prepare for that and guard against it. But as you say, it's never going to be the be-all, end-all. But what's the alternative, right? What would happen if tomorrow we just said, you know what, forget it. Let's just get rid of all the testing, or at least get rid of all the stakes attached. What would happen? And there's a lot of reason to believe that a lot of not good things would happen.
Yeah.
You know, that many of the schools, especially serving the neediest kids, would go back to teaching nothing.
Well, and there are other ways to get around the cheating problem as well. You can have, the tests become wildly too predictable from year to year. I think test security is a real issue. I think that you could have variations, it's all the test security thing. You could have variations among different tests that are actually being administered. You can score them differently. Mm-hmm. The quote easy answer is to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but it's not the best answer.
It is not. If throwing babies is never the answer.
It's true.
All right. Thank you very much. Great conversation. Great debate. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Pamela. And it is now time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, and I'll ask this to you, Kathleen. So when you hear about these cheating stories about teachers, I mean, when you were teaching, did this even cross your mind that some of your peers might be cheating on these kinds of standardized tests?
Well, I actually don't think the accountability pressure was as bad as when I was in the classroom.
Bad?
I mean, it was...
official policy line at Fordham is that accountability is good.
I mean, the pressure on teachers is bad. Accountability is good.
Yes.
I don't think I felt the pressure that teachers feel today. I mean, when I was teaching, you had to put the standard on the board, it had to be visible, but it wasn't as much about the test results as just the standards then, because even that was new, right? Yeah. Having a real standard.
Standardized tests that you had to give? You were in high school.
There were. Yep. There was in North Carolina, it was an end of course test though, as I'm remembering. Yeah. 10th grade, it was like a writing. I don't know what grade you taught, but it was like a writing test in 10th grade. So anyway.
I never, at Achievement First, I mean, we were very data-driven. The scores mattered enormously to us and our schools, and I never worried for one second that anybody was cheating. I mean, it would have been such an affront to the culture, and so I do believe that some of this is a leadership. I think people are right to hold the leaders accountable because it's a leadership problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, Amber, what you got for us this week?
We got a new study out by Ken Wong on mayoral control. It's called Mayoral Governance and Student Achievement. This is sort of Wong's, pet research topic. He's long studied this, and here he examines the effects of it on student achievement, once again, and resource allocation. So he's analyzed 11 districts that were governed by some degree of mayoral leadership during 1999 to 2010. Meaning the mayor had a direct control of at least some of the schools. He compares student progress in these districts to the statewide average and controls for variation in student demographics. He finds that mayoral control districts have generally improved district-wide performance relative to average school district performance statewide. Though it varies across districts, it's uneven by grade and subject. These studies, you get into the weeds, and once you drill down, it's like, well, it did in fourth grade, it did in eighth grade, but it didn't do in this subject. If you really care about it, you need to dig into the study. Specifically, 5 of the 11 made substantial improvement in narrowing the achievement gap within their states: New York, New Haven, Chicago, Philly, Baltimore. In 4, Hartford, Harrisburg, Boston, and Providence, the progress, again, was sporadic. Wong also examined performance on NAEP for the 7 TUDA districts and found improvements in New York, Boston, and some degree in Chicago. Finally, in-depth school-level analysis. So the study goes through various sort of cross tabs and various different degree units of analysis. But finally, there was a school level analysis in New York. It showed mayoral control increases the percentage of students in a school who are proficient on state standards by 1 to 3% annually. Sounds small, but in a large district, you know, that can add up. Finally, finds a positive relationship between mayoral control districts and more spending on instruction. All this is, none of this is causal, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to keep in mind that it matters who the mayor is, and it matters what powers the mayor has.
Yeah, and what policies they pursue. Right. Yeah, I understand. I followed some of the debate on Twitter after this was out from the New York crowd. Of course, these debates we've had always looking at the New York data, whether he was looking at the right years or not. It's tricky because as with the rest of the country, there were these big gains in the very end of the 90s, early 2000s in New York. And so do you count those or not? Or when do you start the clock?
Right.
It is also true that if you look at any big city over the last decade, that for the most part, they are closing achievement gaps with the states.
I think so.
Yeah. Yep, I mean, so that's the other question is whether, you know, you'd want to maybe compare this to some cities that did not have mayoral control, because a lot of those probably closed achievement gaps as well. The resource thing is interesting. What he really is saying is that these cities end up lowering class sizes.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
You know, which is it's seen as something that parents want.
Yeah.
And is maybe in some ways, what, better than just spending on overhead or bureaucracy?
Yeah.
Anti-reformers for mayoral control.
And Leonie Hamden should be pushing for
mayoral control.
They lower class sizes. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, no, this is important debate, and of course, is a part of a larger initiative we have going on at Fordham with the Center for American Progress, looking at governance reforms. Mm-hmm. And when we get down to it, and people say, "Well, what do you mean, governance reform?" Well, mayoral control is one of those things that we are looking at. Though I'm becoming more optimistic about the recovery school district model myself.
Why is that?
Well, because I think at least in some of these states, they are trying to make sure that these districts have a lot more authority than even a mayor would. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, be able to pull these low performing schools out of a district and not have to abide by the union contract or by the, you know, deal with the district's larger dysfunction or all of that, that you can kind of get away from those issues. Whereas, you know, mayoral control, you know, might be able to push on the unions or on some of these other issues, but it's not guaranteed.
And it varies. I mean, that's one thing I learned. Mayoral control looks different in all of these various places. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they can appoint the school board. In some cases, they can appoint some members of the school board, but not all. In some cases, they only have direct control over some number of schools. So, you know, it's really the model itself is not consistently
It's not
applied.
Really a thing. It's not really a reform.
Yeah.
Right. But the impulse to say, look, we have too many cooks in the kitchen, as well as we need to make sure that we have people in charge who really are responsive to the public. You know, this argument that school boards, because so few people turn out for their elections, they're so easily captured by the unions and others, that is a big problem in these cities. You know, I think there's still reasons to believe that this is the case. All right. Great. Thank you, Amber. Thank you, Kathleen. That's all of our time. Until next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter-McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.